If you're looking for a restful vacation, an escape plan, a quiet time, go to Ten Killer.
She was asking for it. You know she was.
But there is no escape. There is no peace.
John.
You may end up dead. Terror at Ten Killer, where the unknown is your worst nightmare. Coming soon to video stores everywhere.
Okay, are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Cue the appropriate music. No. I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price, welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
Thank you, Michael H. Price. Very happy to be here with Fort Worth's Renaissance Man for another round of our podcast, of our Forgotten Horrors podcast. And Michael, this time we're talking about another one of those pictures that was made here in Tulsa, where I'm talking from, and of course you're talking from Fort Worth.
Yeah.
Now, let me give a little context, if I may. This is the year after the Tulsa-made Blood Cult became essentially, I mean, I know there's some argument could be made, but essentially the first made-for-home video movie ever, 1985, for United Entertainment. And this was United Entertainment as well, but it was the next year, 1986, because what happened, those who of you who may not have heard us talk about Blood Cult, it was made for about $20,000 and it grossed about $1 million. Things were much different, of course, in the home video market in those days. But it was a cash cow, and it led United Entertainment to commission other movies, including this one. And so it came out a year later. And I'm just curious, Michael, what with your critical faculties, what do you make of this?
I think Blood Cult is a much more accomplished picture.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They were learning and trying to do the best they could. The filmmakers on Blood Cult, they were learning a new technology. They were figuring out how to get away with this audacious concept. Not sequel, but the follow-through, Terror at Ten Killer, is a much more conventional film.
It is. That's very interesting.
Much more. It reminds me a lot of what. This is 6 years after Friday the 13th.
Yes.
And approximately 6 years after one of the bandwagon pictures that followed Friday the 13th, called The Burning.
Mm-hmm.
which was interestingly a production of the company that became the highfalutin Miramax Pictures.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, was that a Texas film then?
No.
It was a Hollywood film.
I'd have to look up the pedigree on The Burning, but mm-hmm. The corporate origins, basically it was Miramax Pictures, the Weinsteins and Embry.
Wow. Okay. All right. So this film, again, the filmmaker was a guy who had worked a lot for OETA, which is Oklahoma Educational Television Network.
Right.
His name is Ken Meyer. He'd done a lot of PBS-style documentaries, including, I believe, Art in Oklahoma was one, and I know a film called Oklahoma Passage, which was a very ambitious film multi-chapter film that celebrated, or video, I suppose, that celebrated Oklahoma's history, and was shot in conjunction with the centennial.
Yeah.
And so Ken Myers is the same guy now who turns around, that's doing these sort of highfalutin historical public TV projects, and decides he's got an idea for a slasher picture. And for those who haven't seen the film, it involves a woman, young woman, and her friend. The young woman is escaping kind of from a bad relationship, and they go to Lake Tenkiller, which is really a lake in Oklahoma. And and has the history, which is sort of unfolds through the course of the film when they talk about Tenkiller and the origins. And then there's some murders, and that's pretty much it, isn't it?
That's pretty much it. It's watching it with a new perspective. I made the mistake of assuming that it might be different.
Imagine your surprise.
It's the same damn picture I saw, but it was new.
Yes, it and, hasn't changed.
You know, not to cast asparagus on the
right.
on the Enterprise, but uh-huh. Yeah, it's like it is what it is, and I'm reminded. Peculiar reminder here. I've been working on the catalog of George Turner, kind of getting his archives, which I inherited, into a little bit more coherent state.
Now, would you like to identify George for the folks
George,
who may not know who he was?
George was my mentor in the newspaper racket, and yes. He was the co-founder of the Forgotten Horrors books. So, you know, this is a guy we owe a lot to. And I got into the period when George was running a private art gallery,
mm-hmm.
and dealing in just, you know, highfalutin, pedigreed fine art pieces. He had just graduated right after World War II from the Art Institute of Chicago, and he came back home to Texas and opened a gallery. And at the same time, and this is where it gets the parallel with Tenkiller shows up, George is paying the bills by doing tourist trap postcard cartoons.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm talking about? It's like, yes, the line between fine art and shirt sleeves art,
mm-hmm.
is very narrow and easily blurred,
especially from the point of view of the creator.
Oh yes, mm-hmm. yes. You know, I mean, I've got an original oil that George did in that period. Portrait of Edgar Allan Poe. It's not a monumental painting, but it is a large oil, probably about 16 by 20, beautifully framed. It's in the studio here. And I look at that frequently because it's hangs up, over the main writing mm-hmm. console.
Right.
And I just pulled up a couple of digital files of some of these postcards, and it's like, can this be the same guy? Well,
right.
And the postcard I'm looking at right now is you remember the tourist traps? We don't have many of them anymore.
Don't have many
But they
anymore,
sold
right.
postcards, and the postcards often had to do with, like, really bizarre or stupid gags. The desk clerk says to the honeymooning cowboy and his bride at the hotel, he says, "Would you like the bridal suite?" And the cowboy says, "I already got a bridle, and don't call me sweet."
So you're talking Stuckey's, Nickerson Farms, that sort of thing.
We're talking about way before Stuckey's.
Okay.
We're talking about Greasy Spoon restaurants on Highway 66.
Oh, of course, of course.
We're talking about curio shops where you could buy damn near anything you could get away with
mm-hmm.
buying.
Mm-hmm.
And the postcard cost a nickel. You look them up on a service like eBay today, and you'll see those nickel postcards going for like tens to hundreds of dollars each.
Right. Well, and I know at Nickerson Farms, or I can't remember Stuckey's or Nickerson Farms, is the first time, although I had no idea, you know, I didn't know you, nothing. I was a kid. But George Turner wrote a series of little sort of touristy books about Oklahoma outlaws or about famous outlaws.
Oh, yeah, the Secrets of Billy, that was the same company that did the postcards.
There you go, and that's how I first encountered your mentor, George Turner, all these years ago.
Yeah, exactly. I did some of the inking on the portraits in those books.
Well, you know, the point becomes then that a person like George Turner or a person like Ken Meyer can do Art in Oklahoma or this multi-layered, multi-houred homage to Oklahoma's history, and then turn around and do something like Terry Tenkiller.
Yeah, I'm sure these. You know, it's kind of like not to say that this actually happens, but it might be kind of like discovering Ken Burns playing in a punk band.
Sure, exactly.
You know, that sort of a dichotomy that only makes an artist all the more interesting.
That's right. That's right.
And that's why a picture like Terry Tenkiller is valuable, because not only did it generate some, dare I say, was it a job creator in Oklahoma?
Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah, it was. Absolutely.
These guys paid their taxes. They employed working artists who I suspect, you know, weren't getting a whole lot of offers in those days, and they contributed to the economy of the state, if not the greater Southwest, simply by making a picture that that a lot of people would just be crazy to see, and a lot of people wouldn't be caught dead watching.
That's exactly right. And, you know, speaking of some of those people, if I may, I've done a little, because I was around, of course, I was working for the Tulsa World when this was made. And the owner of the cafe, the little small-town cafe around Lake Tenkiller, is a fellow named Dean Lewis. As far as I know, this is his only... this is his only dramatic part, but he was a Tulsa TV anchor, had been a Tulsa TV anchor, news anchor at Channel 2 in Tulsa, which is the NBC affiliate here. The guy that plays Tor, who is the handyman, the sort of hunky handyman in the film, who is at, once the two girls flee the abusive boyfriend and go to the cabin at Tenkiller, there's a handyman there that is kind of a romantic interest. And his name was Mike Wiles in the picture, but he ended up being a guy named Michael Seamus Wiles.
Sure.
And I don't know, he's from Washington State, but Michael, some way or another, he has a Tulsa connection, because he was later on in Cold Justice, which was a Western that was made here in Tulsa, direct-to-video Western, that played a little bit on Cinemax. But he's been in Fight Club, he's been in Transformers, playing some small roles, but still.
And shows up in Breaking Bad.
Yes, he does, in Sons of Anarchy as well. Now...
And
yes.
So, yeah, this is, well, it's probably a university connection in Oklahoma.
I would suspect that would be right. On the other hand, the female lead, and I'm so glad at my advanced age I sometimes misremember things, but I remember that Stacey Logan, who plays the female lead, the blonde girl, was a Miss Oklahoma. Yeah. And, in fact, she was a Miss Oklahoma USA back in 1981, 5 years before this picture was made. The interesting thing about her was... she was from OCU, Oklahoma City University, which was which turned out a lot of theatrical people. She did a lot of the lyric theater in Oklahoma City, sort of like some of the people from Stark Fair that we talked about several weeks ago came from that same lyric theater. But she, at the same time, and this is one of those coincidences. This is not scholarly, Michael, but this one's coincidences we both love. At the same year that Terry Tenkiller was released, she went on a bus and truck tour with Stop the World, I Want to Get Off.
Oh, my gosh.
So there you go.
Okay, versatility for you.
There's Ken Burns again. You know, you're talking about, not Ken Burns, Ken Meyer, that whole deal.
Ken Meyer,
Ken
versatility.
Meyer. Later on,
versatility will see you through a whole lot of interesting twists and turns.
And, you know, as a writer, I know John D. McDonald said something once I thought was very interesting. Of course, you and I are both Pulp fans, and McDonald said, you know, people disparage the writers for the pulps back in the 30s and 40s, wrote a little formulaic stuff, but he said, you know, when you're a writer, you find a market, and you learn the parameters of the market, and then you write the very best that you can. And I suspect that that's what they were all doing with this picture. I mean, that's why I believe you and I, on this particular podcast, there's just not much snark, because we know, don't we?
Actually, there's a lot of earnest artistry at work in Ten Killer.
There is.
The script, well, you know, what do you call it? It doesn't break ground. It doesn't betray the genre.
No.
It does not contain any particularly big ideas, but the performances are earnest. The timing is good. If you just kick back and roll with the flow, it's got some good scares in it.
It does. It's not it's an entertaining picture. And the only bad picture, as we've often said here, is a picture that bores you. And this one doesn't. This one, I mean, people might say, there's a little too much talking, but hey, I think it works out just fine. Now, the dark-haired girl, the second female lead, Michelle Merchant. Yes. I covered her. She did a lot of dinner theater around Tulsa. And I remember she was very good. She's maybe the best actor in the picture. And I remember covering her. I don't know what happened to her, but I remember covering her doing dinner theater. And then Kevin Meyer, who plays the spurned boyfriend, was Ken Meyer's son. Now, Ken directed it. Yeah, Ken's wife wrote it. And then Kevin played one of the major parts. Now, he actually played for Barry Switzer at Oklahoma University for a time as a football player. And then he has now written several at this time we're talking, he's written several direct-to-video pictures as well. So he actually used this as a springboard to a career, just as Michael Seamus Wiles did.
And more power to it.
More power to all of it.
That's exciting. It's nice to know, dinner theater, road show, tours, what have you. It's nice to know, and the first response is, gosh, shouldn't I be surprised? No.
Mm-hmm.
What did Lou Gehrig say? What do actors do?
Actors act.
Actors act.
Writers write and actors act.
Yeah,
that's
right. I mean, it's the same thing. It's the same thing that Boris Karloff called the dignity of honest work.
Or as you said, when I was getting ready to do the graphic novel for Plan 9 from Outer Space, that you knew that I would keep the shabby dignity of the piece. It's the same thing. There's a little shabby dignity going on here, I think.
Now, I think there is.
I must tell you that I know this because David Powell, unfortunately, who passed away as a young man, did the makeup effects for United Entertainment, or VCI. The names are interchangeable. They sort of went back and forth. But they're VCI right now, but United, and still around, of course, but United Entertainment. He even painted the cover for the original VHS tape release, but he told me a little secret that not a lot of people know, and that is that when Ken Meyer delivered the picture, there was not enough gore to satisfy Bob Blair, who was the head of United Entertainment. So a year later or so, they had to go back in and add a little bit of nudity and some graphic horror effects. Anytime you see that, like the throat slit at the very beginning, the knife in the middle, and Michelle Merchant doing a very quick sort of topless scene, that came along a year later, which leads me to a story that may be apocryphal. But Michelle Merchant, in the time between the time they actually shot Terror 10 Killer, and then they shot the new footage with her. She has a scene where she goes into the bedroom, and she takes off her halter top and puts on a bikini top, and then comes back out, right? You remember that scene?
Oh, yeah.
Well, they shot that a year afterwards, and according to Dave, she had breast augmentation surgery between the two. In that intervening year. And so that means, and if you really look for this, and those folks who want to look at Terror 10 Killer and look for this scene, she really is much, much less flat-chested in the one scene. So she goes into the bedroom door. She opens the bedroom door. We go to the new footage. She changes her tops. She comes back out, and she's flat again. And it's pretty, if you really know what to look for, it's very obvious.
That's interesting, because I didn't study the scene closely.
Right, I understand.
I swear. But no, I had a sense that a lot of these more sensational bits of business played out like afterthoughts.
That's very perspicacious, because they did. And, you know, at that point, keep in mind, Michael, you remember, because you were there from 86 or 85 to 86, how much the ante was upped on direct-to-video, how much you had to show on direct-to-video, or how much you had to give people something, right?
And oh, yeah, sure.
If you didn't give them a name actor by 86, and you had to give them some gore. So Dave Powell, God bless him, I remember him calling me one time at the Tulsa World, and he was just put out. I said, well, Dave, what's wrong? He says, you know, they want me to chainsaw a girl for this new movie in a week. He says, do you know how much trouble that is? Do you know how hard it is to chainsaw a girl? And then he starts going into this graphic description. To him, it had nothing to do with horror. It was a job like we're talking about, just like anybody else would approach, like Ken Meyer would approach. It was a job. Exactly. And he was trying to do the best that he could. And I really think that's what we have here. We have people trying to do the best that they can, because this is a fairly earnest picture, if nothing else.
It has no tongue-in-cheek attitude to it. That may be a drawback, depending on where you stand with this sort of picture. But I admire that earnestness.
It's guileless, isn't it, in a lot of ways?
There are no, apart from the technical aspect of fooling the camera into seeing things that aren't happening,
right?
Like your gore effects, for example. There is no deceit.
Yes, good point.
It plays out like, the principal plot could be a Lifetime Channel movie.
You're absolutely right, and it was written by a woman. Not to be sexist about it, but it does have a female sensibility.
It does have a female sensibility, and it does have a really absolutely worthless, no good man at the heart of the story.
Yeah, and some on the periphery as well.
Yes, exactly.
Or at least one on the periphery, yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, that's a good point, yeah. And so it is. It's without the murders, it's like a Lifetime Channel movie. I guess that's true, because there's a lot of the girls talking, you know, her... Michelle Merchant's character trying to talk Stacey Logan's character out of going back to the basically abusive boyfriend and all that, and then they just lay some killing on it, you know? This was an earnest piece of work. It's not a great picture. Nobody's going to say, we're certainly not here to say it's like the most wonderful thing since Psycho, but it's an earnest picture, and it's an entertaining picture, I think.
And it's got its moments.
It certainly has got its moments,
and I really think you have to be in the right frame of mind to watch a picture like this.
But, you certainly do.
But I would certainly put it up there. You know, there are pictures of that period that do sustain interest in the present day. Just Before Dawn, for example, a picture of that nature. The picture with the probably the most lurid title I've run across in the past 30 years, The Naked Massacre.
I don't know Naked Massacre.
That was one of those old straight-to-video living room grindhouse pictures that I ran across on back when the video rental stores started selling off their rental inventory for $5 a piece. I picked it up out of curiosity. I said, okay, the title's too lurid to ignore. It turned out to be not a bad picture. A lot of those latter-day grindhouse and straight-to-video pictures are interesting today as partly as relics of a place and a time, and certainly as relics of a kind of a DIY filmmaking, do-it-yourself filmmaking movement.
It was a time when, there for a very brief period after Christopher Lewis did Blood Cult, that you could get together and make a picture and have a chance of it showing up in a lot of living rooms all over the country and even the world.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that was a fascinating thing. I was in a picture. Yeah, I know you made several pictures. I was in a picture called Party Crasher, made in Tulsa. And you know, up playing a reggae version of House of the Rising Sun with my band. And the the producer and director told me a while back that it really went through the roof in South Africa. And I'm thinking about some family in South Africa watching me in a Hawaiian shirt playing House of the Rising Sun on my Vox Jaguar with my band, and I'm thinking, you know, the possibilities then for it was a small window, though. It was a very small window, because pretty soon you started having to get stars in it, and then there were certain stars who would work in these sorts of pictures, and then you had to up the ante and up the ante. But there probably, what, a year, 2 years in the mid-'80s, you could make
certainly in that 85 to maybe 88 or thereabouts, when you could generate something just by the seat of the pants and make it sail.
Right, and you could actually, there was just open, it was wide open for you to take a chance. And, of course, again, United Entertainment here in Tulsa really sort of blazed the trail for that.
Yeah.
And I, you know, Tulsa could have been a place where all of that happened. It didn't quite work out. But we left a bunch of pictures, including Terror Teen Killer.
There's a double feature from VCI.
VCI has a double feature that you can get it with their I've got it right here, I think. Last Slumber Party, which was a pickup from VCI that Jill Clark picked up. She was doing a lot of acquisitions for him at the time. Picked it up from the East Coast and then got the heavy metal band in Tulsa, First Strike, to do the soundtrack. But it was a time we won't see again. It's a little bit like, and this is a whole different can of worms, a little bit like the black and white era of comics that you and I were both involved in as well.
Yeah,
comic books.
Exactly.
So, speaking of that, let's talk about what have you got out there that if folks would like to support this podcast by considering purchasing our stuff. What would lead with?
Well, we're just about to send Forgotten Horrors Volume 8 off to press.
And that's all you, right?
That's the one that I just bolted on through.
Yep.
In fact, I may prevail on you to do some proofreading on that.
Sure,
since
be glad
you're mentioned
to.
In the manuscript.
I would be glad to.
Think of it as a sneak preview.
Right.
Anyway.
And what is your most recent comics from the Gone World?
That would have to be the mouthful of a title, Journey into Weird Mysteries of Strange Fear.
Which I just read and I loved it. Plenty of cops and donuts, existentialism, plenty of theater of the absurd. It's all there wrapped around Ajax Farrell.
Yeah, it's the funniest horror comic book you'll ever read. actually, we're just about to go into print at IDW Press, meanwhile, with the collection called Ghosts and Girls of Fiction House.
Nice. Very
which
nice.
Which will contain a good selection of the 1940s Ghost Gallery feature.
Right.
From
you preview, I think, in your latest Forgotten Horror.
Yeah.
Latest,
yes, we did. You know, had a little preview
of that. World. Yeah.
Same company that did Sheena, Queen of the Jungle, and
mm-hmm.
a whole lot of others.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of torn as to which direction to jump in. I've got a new exhibit of gallery exhibit of watercolors in progress for next year. Portraits of great jazz musicians from Texas.
Very good. Very good.
And it just, you know, the torture never stops.
No, it never does. You're going to do it till you get it right, aren't you? I feel the same way. I've got a couple of things out that I might mention. One of them is Bold Venture Press out of Florida. has published my original Dan Turner script, which is set in the 1980s before they, you know, Dan Turner Hollywood Detective ended up as a major TV movie with Mark Singer and Tracy Scoggins and gosh, Paul Bartel and a lot of folks. And the first draft, they asked me to set it in contemporary times because they thought that they had Ray Parker Jr. to play Dan Turner, who was just a few years removed from his Ghostbuster stuff. Yeah. And so I wrote it as an 80s thing, and then they turned around in a week. I had to change it back to the 40s. And so the 80s script, nobody's ever seen it. And Rich Harvey down at Bold Venture Press has asked me if he could reprint it. And I said, be glad to. Plus, he reprinted it, the original story that it was based on. So we've got that, and we've also got, you know, the Twilight Avenger graphic novel seems to be doing very well out there, and as well as some of the other stuff that we've got going, Hardboiled Christmas Stories. The holidays are coming. Yeah. You know, you're going to want to pick up some Hardboiled Christmas Stories for that hard-to-buy-for person on your list.
Ah, yes, the Santa Claus imperative. We've both got a couple of Christmas books out.
We both do. You got a Christmas CD out.
Got to be more. You know, I mean, you just can't stop once you start it.
Well, now your Christmas CD. You've got a couple of Christmas CDs. The big
I think since we incorporated the studio 5 years ago, we've got 75 titles in print.
Oh, my.
Books and CDs.
So how do people find that so they can look over your stuff?
That's all at Amazon. All you got to do is type in my name at Amazon.com, and there they are. Same way with your stuff.
Very good. And I might mention, Jim Vance and I have just done the introduction to the Jet Powers collection of Bob Powell comic book stories from Dark Horse and Kitchen Sink, and that's coming out in October, too. Michael?
Beautiful.
Very much fun, as always. I appreciate it. And
won't be long.
It won't be long now. We'll be back in touch before you know it. And we want to thank everyone for listening. We found out, as if you Google us, you'll find out we're being mentioned on a lot of like websites and things. And it's just really gratifying. We really appreciate it. And Michael deserves it. I'm not sure that I do. But
we're all in it together.
Are we ever. We'll be back at you soon.
Mighty fun.